So thank you very much for that wonderful introduction. I am so pleased to be here. I'm going to tell you two things which are private and confidential. The first is that the Secretary of Health and Physician General drinks Diet Coke in the morning. And the second, this is a very big year for me. This is the 30th anniversary of my 30th birthday. So there you go. So both of those now, you're sworn to secrecy. You cannot tweet them or do anything else to talk about that. Well, thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here. What I want to do is to talk about, well, first I have no disclosures, is to talk about some of the public health crises and issues that we're dealing with in Pennsylvania, and then relate that to all of the extremely important work that you do, and we all do, in terms of teaching medical students. So we're going to talk in 45 minutes about the opioid crisis, medical marijuana, LGBT health issues, and public health. And actually, I've cut this down a lot. So I do speak quickly, but if I speak too quickly, then, I don't know, raise your hand or throw something and I'll slow down. As has been mentioned, by far the biggest public health crisis that we face in Pennsylvania, and you could argue in the nation, is the opioid crisis. In Pennsylvania, in 2016, over 4,600 individuals died from drug overdoses. That was a 37% increase from 2015. The preliminary data for 2017 is that we'll be over 5,000 deaths, maybe significantly over 5,000 deaths. That means that over 13 Pennsylvanians a day die of drug overdoses, and that is by far, both in Pennsylvania and in the United States, much greater than those that die of car accidents. It is the public health crisis of our time. If you look at these slides, and I think you could see them, this is CDC data through 2015. Overdose deaths from opioids have gone up, that's the green line, significantly. At first, it was commonly prescribed opioids, short-acting and long-acting, in sort of the purple line, which has plateaued over the last number of years. Let's see, do I have that? Yeah. No. And then you can see in the blue line, the spike in heroin, which started around 2010. And then in the last number of years, in the orange line, the spike of synthetic fentanyl analogs. And all of this has led to the crisis that we have throughout the nation. This is Pennsylvania's data from 2016. And so one of the highlights is that this is not just an urban issue. We have seen in the past other drug crises that we have faced, which have been primarily in urban areas. But this is, in Pennsylvania and throughout the nation, an urban issue. This is a suburban issue. And this is a rural issue. The death rate in some of our rural counties is as high, if not higher, than the death rate in Philadelphia. There is a many different etiologies to this, which we'll talk about, but one of them is the social determinants of health, which was discussed. And there is a strong pattern in terms of economic disadvantaged individuals. So whether those are economic disadvantaged individuals in North Philadelphia or economic disadvantaged individuals in Fulton County or Cambria County, who have no hope and are more susceptible to opioids and heroin. I'd like to highlight the previous Surgeon General's report, Dr. Vivek Murthy, released in November of 2016. It was the first ever Surgeon General's report on addiction, and I think it is really extremely compelling reading. So how did we get here? Well, this is a evolution over the last 20 or 30 years. I think many of us in the room remember the emphasis on identifying and treating pain, which started in the late 80s and through the 90s and the 2000s, that pain became the fifth vital sign, and we all had the smiley faces. And so even in adolescent medicine clinic, seeing a patient with eating disorders, I was required to assess and document my 15-year-old patient's acute or chronic pain and then come up with a treatment plan for that pain. And then patient satisfaction scores were tied to this, and actually CMS reimbursement was tied to this. So unfortunately, the expectation became that not only were we going to treat pain, not only were we going to assess and treat it, but we were going to eradicate it, that we were going to eradicate acute and chronic pain. And at the same time was the development of extremely powerful, long-acting opioid pain medications, of which you know. And in 20 years, the amount of prescription opioids sold in the United States went up 400%. So that since 2012, we write enough prescriptions for opioids for every American adult to have their very own bottle. And I'll give you a statistic. 80% of individuals who use heroin actually started with a prescription opioid that they obtained either legally or illegally. Now that's different than how many people that are using opioids end up using heroin. That's about 4 to 7%, so these are different. But if you end up using heroin, you started with a prescription opioid that either you obtained legally or illegally. Many of our patients took the pills, but many of the patients didn't take the pills, and they sat in their medicine cabinets and then diverted into the community in 1,000 different ways. At the same time, heroin availability in the United States has been increasing. Heroin seizures have increased significantly, and it is very pure, plentiful, and cheap heroin, so that it is, I'm sure, down the street here for $7 a bag. In many places in Pennsylvania, it might be $5 a bag for heroin. So where the prescription opioids illicitly are rather expensive, this heroin is extremely cheap. And it's even worse than that, because really the biggest compound that we're seeing in overdoses now are synthetic fentanyl. Now this is not fentanyl that is diverted from the fentanyl patches that patients with severe pain might use. This is actually artificial synthetic fentanyl made in laboratories, primarily in Asia, and then sold either through the cartels from Central and South America or actually through the dark web in the mail to people. So this fentanyl can be used to cut heroin. It can be pressed into pills. Majority of overdose deaths that we see are the result of fentanyl now. Now, as you know, fentanyl is 50 to 100 times more powerful than morphine. So you can see the potential of even a small amount of fentanyl, and it's cheaper to make the fentanyl than it is actually even to produce the heroin. So they use it to cut the heroin. And we have even seen in Pennsylvania and other areas in the Midwest, in the Mid-Atlantic, carfentanil. How many people know what carfentanil is? Some. Carfentanil is literally an opioid analgesic designed for elephants. It is a large animal veterinary anesthetic. And we have seen synthetic carfentanil. It is 100 times more powerful than fentanyl. If you do the math, it means it's 10,000 times more powerful than morphine. And obviously, even a very small amount is lethal. And this is what we're seeing throughout Pennsylvania and much of the United States. So what do we do? This is the public health crisis of our time. So one of the things that we are doing is that considering this a public health problem. So there is certainly a public safety and law enforcement response, and public health has to work hand in hand with law enforcement. But by nature, this is a public health problem. What the law enforcement experts tell us is that we will never get rid of the supply if we don't decrease the demand. And that falls to public health and to all of us in this room. So in relating to medical school education, we have worked with medical schools. So we actually had a convening of all of the deans of the medical schools of the state, and that is the allopathic and osteopathic medical schools, of which total are about 10. And over the course of a year and 1,000 phone calls, we developed a set of core competencies for medical students. Every graduating medical student should have about these issues. And the core competencies included pain, how to assess acute and chronic pain, how to treat acute and chronic pain, emphasizing the limited role of opioids in treating chronic non-cancer pain. Chronic non-cancer pain, pretty limited actually, much more limited than what we have done in the last 20 or 30 years. But also, of course, about opioids and their pharmacology and their risks and benefits and how to start someone on opioids, how to wean them off opioids. And then also about substance abuse, how to do ESPERT, a brief intervention and referral to treatment. How to assess someone who might have an addiction if they need medicine for pain, and how to essentially refer, and then basics about how to treat the disease of addiction. And so every medical student should have those tools. That is published in Pain Medicine. It was written by Dr. Michael Ashburn, who is the head of the pain clinic at Penn. I was pleased to co-author that. It has been released with all the medical schools. And each medical school is coming up with their own curriculum about how to do that. Penn's is excellent, and I believe it's online. The term I like to use for all of these efforts is opioid stewardship. Opioid stewardship, and it's actually first coined by Penn State Hershey, to be completely fair. But I like that term because the parallel is to antibiotic stewardship. Well, as we know, antibiotics are essential medicines, and they're one of the wonders of the 20th century of medicine. But because of the overuse of antibiotics, both in medicine and also in agriculture, we have tremendous problems with microbial resistance. Well, at the same time, we have learned and are learning to use antibiotics much more carefully and judiciously. Thus, antibiotic stewardship, you've heard though that term. Well, I'm talking about opioid stewardship, is that opioids are essential medicines. And if you're in one of your hospitals and you have a fractured leg, then I'm sure you need an opioid. And if you had a major operation this morning, you need an opioid. And if you have chronic non-cancer pain, maybe you don't, but if you have cancer or end-of-life pain, you need an opioid. So we're not trying to get rid of opioids. They're essential medicines in our medical toolbox. But we have to learn to use opioids much more carefully and much more judiciously, and we need to teach our students and residents to do that. We also have actually CME for all medical providers, all dispensers and prescribers in Pennsylvania. It is now required for our license by the legislature. We have developed CME online with all of the professional societies, which was a collaboration between Pennsylvania Medical Society and the Nursing Society and the nurse practitioners and physicians assistants and podiatrists, dentists and pharmacists, all at the same table to produce these continuing education credits which count towards our license. We have written 10 opioid prescribing guidelines, and these dovetail with the CDC guidelines. And these include specialty and location specific. So one of the newer ones we have is pediatric and adolescent guidelines. We have emergency department guidelines, dental guidelines, pharmacist guidelines, geriatrics, OBGYN, orthopedics and sports medicine, etc. And these all have been taken to the professional boards, such as the Board of Medicine and Osteopathic Medicine, for their affirmation and acceptance to develop essentially a standard of care in terms of the use of opioids. And we also have a prescription drug monitoring program. I believe all states now have a prescription drug monitoring program. We were the 48th state. And the advantage of being the 48th state is that you get to learn best practices from all the 47 other states. And so we have actually quite a robust, excellent prescription drug monitoring program. The legislature has required prescribers and dispensers to check the prescription drug monitoring program for opioids and for benzodiazepines, and it's required to do it with the first prescription for other controlled substances. And even though that started off to be challenging for medical practices, statistics show that if you don't make a prescription drug monitoring program mandatory, we don't check it. So it has to be mandatory. But we have worked. One is on a collaborative with other states. So our PDMP connects with other states' PDMPs, particularly contiguous, but even Texas and some other states. And we are working with a grant from the CDC and SAMHSA to integrate it with the electronic medical records in Pennsylvania. So it is seamlessly starting to integrate with hospitals and health systems and eventually actually even physicians' practices in Pennsylvania, so you don't have to close down one field and then open that up and then close that and open up that one. It'll seamlessly populate your electronic medical record. What has gone is that this has gone from a pain in the neck a year and a half ago to an essential part of medical practice. And so we have to teach our students and residents how to use the prescription drug monitoring program effectively. We have decreased opioid prescribing with these stewardship efforts 13% in a year. 13% in a year. We will continue to do that. Now, it's never going to be zero because, again, patients need opioids. We don't want people to suffer. So this is a balance, and we have to teach that balance. We don't want people to suffer, but opioids have been significantly overprescribed, and it is one of the risk factors for the opioid crisis that we see today. Now, one very important aspect of this, though, is what do you do if you find that someone suffers from the disease of addiction? If you say, Mr. Smith, you're getting multiple prescriptions, leave my practice, then Mr. Smith, if he can't get his prescription opioids, is going to get heroin. And so you have to do a warm handoff, which I'll talk about in a second, a facilitated referral to treatment for that patient suffering from the disease of addiction. As was mentioned, we have to expand the use of naloxone. Naloxone is not a new medicine. We've used naloxone for a long time. But in this community context, it is new. And so naloxone is safe and effective. You can't get high or addicted to it. And so in 2015, I signed two standing orders, one for first responders. Since that time, first responders in Pennsylvania have saved over 6,000 lives using naloxone. Thank you. In addition, I signed a standing order for the public, so anyone can go to a pharmacy and obtain naloxone based upon my prescription as physician general. Who knew I could do that? Had to be vetted by 475 attorneys to allow that. And we actually have support from the pharmaceutical company that makes it to have naloxone available at schools. This is the naloxone that we're talking about, the naloxone nasal spray, the pre-filled medication tube with the atomization device, and the auto-injector. So my standing order does not include drawing it up with a needle and injecting it because of the complexity, but also the risk of contagion with hepatitis and HIV. So again, 6,456 reversals with first responders. We also have take-back boxes. We have the most take-back boxes in the country. We have 679 prescription take-back boxes, not only in municipal police stations, but more and more with pharmacies and with hospitals, so that if people have excess medicine, particularly controlled substance medicine, they can bring it there and get rid of it, as opposed to leaving it in their medicine cabinet where it gets diverted, or flushing it down the toilet where it goes into our water. I mentioned the warm handoff. We have developed a warm handoff clinical pathway with our emergency medicine colleagues so that patients in the emergency department, after being resuscitated, can get referred to treatment. Because naloxone is absolutely necessary, but it is not sufficient. Because it is very challenging for patients and healthcare providers and families and first responders when people are resuscitated over and over and over again. Now, I reject completely any suggestion that people shouldn't be resuscitated. That three strikes, you're out, or something like that. I think everybody deserves a chance at life, and everybody deserves a chance at recovery. It's impossible to access treatment and recovery if you're dead. And naloxone allows that. But we do need to improve our ability to get people into treatment. And we have expanded treatment with an emphasis on medication-assisted treatment with 45 centers of excellence for patients with Medicaid and programs which we call PACMAT. Not Pac-Man, actually, but PACMAT, which is Pennsylvania Coordinated Medication-Assisted Treatment. It's a hub-and-spokes model utilizing health systems and their addiction specialists and their primary care spokes, where actually the primary prescribers of buprenorphine or Vivitrol would be you, would be primary care physicians in the community with backup from the addiction medicine specialists to help develop policies, procedures, quality control, help with referrals, with consultations, and help with case management so that each primary care practice doesn't have to reinvent that. And we're expanding that throughout the state. So I'm going to move on, actually, from opioids because we're hitting a couple of different topics. But I think that opioid stewardship and how to address opioids doesn't have to be Pennsylvania-specific mechanisms, but that topic is essential to medical school education at this time because of the severe nature of this quote-unquote epidemic. The other thing I want to talk about, which is a little different, but this has become big in Pennsylvania, is medical marijuana. How many physicians here or medical providers here have states where they have medical marijuana? Yeah, so that's why I wanted to talk about this. So we have a medical marijuana bill approximately 2 years ago, and I want to talk about aspects of that, and this is something else, actually, that medical students will need to know about, either because they might be referring patients or prescribing it, or they will have patients who are on it and will need to know what it means. So we have, with our program, we have a medical marijuana advisory work group for physicians. We had a safe harbor program for kids who needed medical marijuana for intractable seizures, that they could get it from other states even before our program started. We have completed regulations. We've issued permits to dispensaries and grower processors. We have a very in-depth electronic tracking mechanism, and we have launched registries. And we are ready to start product distribution in the next month or two. There is a physician registry, so if you want to be a physician that refers patients for medical marijuana, you register. And you have to have 4 hours of CME, and there are five licensed providers of that CME. Some of it can be in person or online. And it's one more tool in the toolbox for physicians for serious medical conditions. We also have a clinical research program, which there is not enough clinical research, and I would absolutely ask the federal government to reschedule marijuana as a Schedule II substance as opposed to a Schedule I substance, because there clearly is at least some medical uses of it, and it shouldn't be the same as heroin. Now, thank you. So these are the conditions that a physician can refer a patient to a dispensary for medical marijuana. ALS, autism, neurological damage with spasticity, cancer, Crohn's disease, epilepsy, glaucoma, HIV/AIDS, Huntington's disease, inflammatory bowel disease. I'm not sure why the legislature had Crohn's separate from inflammatory bowel disease, but that's fine. Intractable seizures. This is particularly children with conditions such as Dravet syndrome or Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, but others who have absolutely intractable seizures, who have responded well to particularly the CBD oil content, cannabidiol oil. Multiple sclerosis, neuropathies, Parkinson's disease, PTSD, sickle cell anemia, or chronic intractable pain. So there's just 17 conditions. It's possible that those will be expanded, but it is obviously serious medical conditions. Relief from chronic pain is by far one of the more common conditions cited by patients for the medical use of cannabis. There is evidence that it's effective for chronic pain. And the idea is, one of the ideas, is it might be an alternative to opioids. And there is some studies that show, and the reference is there, that medically supervised marijuana use is associated with decreased overdose deaths, opioid prescribing, opioid misuse, and opioid addiction. Now, I have to be careful of not raising expectations that we're going to solve the opioid crisis in the back of medical marijuana, because that is not true. But it will be another tool in the toolbox to treat patients with chronic pain as opposed to chronic opioids. It allows patients and actually registered caregivers with a patient certification from a practitioner to obtain medical marijuana from a dispensary. So if you as a physician register for the program and take the CME, you will be a certified practitioner. You actually don't prescribe the medical marijuana. What you do is certify the patient has multiple sclerosis or one of the other conditions, and you refer the patient to a dispensary, which will look like a pharmacy, where they receive the medical marijuana. Now, you can identify if you are really into the weeds on this topic. That's a joke. had to tell people. It's not good when I have to tell people that it's a joke. But if you know a lot about medical marijuana, you can say, I want this tincture at this dose. But if you don't, you can say, this patient has multiple sclerosis or chronic intractable pain, and I think they would do well with medical marijuana. And actually, at the dispensary, will be a pharmacist or physician to help you. Now, the legal forms of medical marijuana in Pennsylvania will be pills, oils, liquids, tinctures, topical, and vaporization. Currently, dry leaf is not part of this, and smoking is not part of the program. So they're not going to be smoking joints. The primary location of the dispensary has to have a pharmacist or physician. The dispensary dispenses the medical marijuana. The practitioner may recommend what the form, or doesn't have to recommend the form, because not everyone is going to have that much knowledge about it. We will have medical marijuana available to patients really within the next couple months. This is a medical system, so no one is going to mistake this for recreational marijuana. This is a medical system. We have a seed-to-sale tracking system. I will know where every seed goes. There is not going to be diversion, and this is not for recreational use. That's a whole other topic. How many people are in states that have recreational marijuana? more and more. However, that's not what we have in Pennsylvania. And at this time, the governor is not supportive of recreational marijuana. We haven't even started the medical marijuana program. But this is providing medicine. Now, I think that we need a more robust research base, absolutely, for many, if not all, of those conditions, but certainly for some of them. And we need more research. We will actually be able to do some. We have funding for research as part of our program. We need marijuana to be rescheduled, and we need to identify the best uses of this potential medicine. But this is not recreational marijuana in Pennsylvania. I get asked over and over again about what Attorney General Sessions is going to do. I don't know what Attorney General Sessions is going to do in terms of marijuana. I think it's much less likely that he's going to ask for prosecution of medical systems. But I'm not prescient and I don't know. But this is a very medical system that I think will provide another tool in the toolbox for physicians. I think this is something that should start to be included in medical school curriculums. I think that because, again, many of us, most of us, live in states that will have medical marijuana programs. And whether you are one of the physicians in the program or not, you're going to have patients that are on medical marijuana. You're going to have patients in your hospital with medical marijuana. So what are you going to do in the hospital? Are you going to dispense it? Are you not going to dispense it? Are you going to allow a caretaker to dispense it? Or are you not going to allow it at all in your hospital? Really, and I'm recommending in Pennsylvania that each hospital come up with their own policies and protocols. What most of the hospitals are doing is that they'll allow the patient and family to bring it in, and the patient and family can self-dispense it, but that it won't be kept in the pharmacy like other medicines, in the hospital pharmacy, because of the federal law. But each hospital has to come up with their own. So I think that medical marijuana needs to start to be part of the medical school curriculum. I'm going to switch gears again. So you had mentioned my advocacy for the LGBT community. So if I say LGBT, I think most of you know what I mean, right? Lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender. But if I say LGBTQQIAAP, how many people know what I mean? Okay, so you know what I mean. So lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender. The first Q is questioning. Individuals that might question their sexual orientation or their gender identity. The second Q is queer. Now, 60-year-old individuals like myself, when you hear the word queer, I still shudder, because queer in the past has been used as a very negative, derogatory term. But queer has actually been taken back by the community and used as an umbrella term very proudly as the community, particularly among young people. So many, many young people, if you ask them how they identify as queer. And it is used as a proud identifying term. I would be intersex. Intersex. So those are individuals who have what we call in medicine a disorder of sexual development, or a disorder of sexual differentiation, a DSD. So those would be individuals who have, say, congenital adrenal hyperplasia with ambiguous genitalia, or late onset congenital adrenal hyperplasia, or androgen insensitivity syndrome, or other types of intersex conditions, which usually will require some evaluation and treatment by a physician. A might be asexual or agender, those who declare that they do not have a sexual orientation or gender identity. And the second A are allies. And allies are individuals who are not LGBTQ, or not on the rainbow, so to speak, but they support the community. And we are very grateful for the support of our allies, which is essential for health equity. The last, the P, can be pansexual, polysexual, pangender, polygender, and there's a million different terms that you'll find that young people will do. I want to differentiate three concepts involved with this, and that's gender roles, sexual orientation, and gender identity and expression. Gender role is what role you might have in your family, in your community that is typically gendered. And let me give you a best example of changing gender roles in our society in the last 75 years. And that's my very dear 93-year-old mother. My mother was the only graduating female law student at Boston University in 1946. My mother graduated law school in 1946. She was a gender maverick. She laughs when I say that. And when women didn't become lawyers or doctors, and now at least 50% of any professional school class will be female. Sexual orientation is who you're attracted to, who you want to have a relationship with, who you might want to be intimate with, traditionally male or female. Your gender identity and expression is how you identify inside and how you want to express that to the world. And there is no overlap between sexual orientation and gender identity. So you might be a male-to-female transgender woman who's attracted to men, women, both, or neither. You might be a female-to-male transgender man who is attracted to men, women, both, or neither. So there is no overlap in that system. Sex is this physical expression of your genes, but as was discussed in the beginning of the talk, gender is this concept of self-perception and how you want to relate to society. And I don't have time to go through the studies, but the hypothesis is that the organic basis of gender identity is a reflection of the neurodevelopment of the brain. And there are a number of studies which suggest that. So this is counter to the idea that it is more Freudian or developmental and it's the way your parents treated you when you were an infant or child. That this is a reflection of neurodevelopment of the brain. And the studies indicate, and these quotes sum it up, gender identity, whether consistent or inconsistent with other characteristics, is not a matter of choice, it's a matter of biology. And the evidence supports the paradigm that it's associated with neurodevelopment of the brain. And there are studies to support that. But it's still a hypothesis. So there is a spectrum of transgender presentation. On one end of the spectrum is someone who wants to express themselves as the other gender. They want to dress as the other gender. But they do not want to transition physically and socially to the other gender. The previous term for that would be transvestite. I recommend that you not use that term. It's considered a negative term in the community. But the current term would be someone who cross-dresses. They might want to cross-dress daily or once a month at a meeting, but that's how they want to express themselves, but they don't want to transition. On the other part of the spectrum is someone who is transsexual, someone who wants to physically and socially transition to the other gender, or that's how they feel they are, and they need to physically kind of actualize that. And everyone in the middle is kind of there too. So people don't pigeonhole into these categories, and gender is very fluid. Gender is very fluid. Transgender can be an umbrella term. Now, I understand that for 99.7% of the people in the world, gender doesn't seem that fluid. You know, you might question many things in your life. You might question your family. You might question your school. You might question your profession, not family medicine, of course, but other professions. But you don't question your gender. It is a fixed star in your universe. But not if you're transgender, and not for me. It always felt wrong from my earliest memories at 4, 5, or 6. And, you know, I was 4, 5, and 6 in the mid-60s, and I was a teenager in the early 70s. Who are you going to tell and what would you say? Now, there's a vocabulary for this, but it always seemed wrong to me. And I know that's not most people's experience, but that's the wonderful diversity of our world. If you are a male to female transitioning, you are a transgender woman. I am a transgender woman. If you're female to male, you're a transgender man or boy. People get that wrong all the time, so just telling you. And that assumes a binary of male and female, but I have to tell you that the brave new world in terms of gender, particularly for young people, is they do not accept that binary of male or female, and they will be anywhere on the spectrum of male and female in terms of their identity and their presentation anytime they want. And they will often purposely tweak your expectations of what you think male and female are. Other terms for that might be gender non-binary, gender non-conforming, gender queer, gender fluid, gender expansive, and that is actually the brave new world in terms of gender. There is a diagnosis in the DSM. It has changed from gender identity disorder in DSM-4 to gender dysphoria in DSM-5. I think when some of the together there are some students here, when you write DSM-6, that being transgender will be out of the DSM. That's an opinion. You have to remember that being gay or lesbian was a mental disorder in the early DSMs until 40 years ago in the mid-70s. And so I think that gender dysphoria, all that is an evolution to have it eventually come out, but we'll see. There is a standard of care for transgender medicine. The World Professional Association for Transgender Health, or WPATH, is the umbrella organization. There is a U.S. arm called USPATH. There are guidelines. There's going to be a new guideline in 2018. And the guidelines are for the evaluation and treatment of patients who are transsexual, meaning if you're cross-dressed, you don't need evaluation and treatment. You're almost by definition not seeking to physically transition. So we're talking people more on this end of the spectrum. It involves a psychological evaluation and treatment, medical evaluation and treatment, with hormonal therapy and surgical therapy. And more hospitals and health systems are developing gender clinics, particularly as more and more insurance coverage exists. This is the medical guideline. This was recently updated in September of 2017, endocrine treatment of gender dysphoric, gender incongruent persons from the Endocrine Society. About a year ago, I had the pleasure to speak to the Endocrine Society about this. It establishes the clinical guidelines for medical evaluation and treatment. It's accepted by all of the relevant organizations, and I highly recommend this reference. It's in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism, and it's very easy to follow. Basically, in terms of hormone replacement therapy, there are male to female regimens. For male to female transition, you need to give an anti-androgen. What we usually use is spironolactone, right? Remember that? Potassium-sparing diuretic. Well, if you remember, it always had the side effect that adult men who took spironolactone would have gynecomastia and have breast development. Now, why they didn't like that, I don't understand. But they didn't. So spironolactone is used for its androgen blockade, as well as giving estrogen. And then the individual is going to go through a female puberty. So they might be 16, 18, 27, or 50, and they're going to go through a female puberty, which takes several years. Female-to-male regimens exist, primarily with androgens. There are no oral androgens that you can take, so primarily we use injectables, testosterone, cypionate, and sesame oil, or you can use topical as well, and the person's going to go through a male puberty. There are significant benefits for that for patients who are transgender, and pretty limited side effects. The main side effect you have to be cautious of is blood clots. Is thromboembolism, just like with any hormones that you prescribe. And if you have a patient with factor V Leiden deficiency, they will not be able to take it. But for the most part, actually, they're very well tolerated. And of course, we really, really want people not to smoke if they're going to do that. Now, what about if you're a young person? What about if you're a teenager? The previous protocol was bummer, see you when you're 18. But there is a new protocol developed in the Netherlands, and there are more and more children's hospitals, including Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and Pittsburgh Children's Hospital in Pennsylvania, also Boston Children's, LA Children's, DC Children's, many clinics now. And so there's two phases. So when a young person presents who's peripubertal, you can use a pubertal blockade with a gonadotropin-releasing hormone agonist to block puberty while they continue counseling and therapy with their family. And then starting somewhere between 14 and 16, you can start to slowly put them through a puberty consistent with their gender identity. And there is more and more research, both in the Netherlands and the United States, on these protocols. And these kids do really, really well with proper treatment. Surgery, you know, we're not surgeons. It used to be called gender confirmation surgery. Now it's called sexual reassignment surgery. Now it's called gender confirmation surgery because you're confirming their inherent gender. There are male to female regimens. Facial feminization surgery, you know, men's faces and women's faces are different. They're structurally different, and you might have a transgender woman with a very male face, prominent chin, frontal bossing, et cetera, that needs surgery. Breast surgery, genital surgery. Genital surgery is very advanced for transgender women. For female-to-male individuals, if they haven't had the pubertal blockade, they almost always will have top surgery or breast surgery. That's a double mastectomy and creation of a male chest. It's completely different than a mastectomy for cancer. And then genital surgery to create male genitals is more challenging, but there are more and more efforts to that. But don't assume everyone wants surgery. In fact, don't make any assumptions at all about LGBTQ people. In fact, don't make any assumptions at all about any of the patients that you see. But don't make assumptions that everybody wants surgery. Don't make assumptions about how they want to have intimate relations and who they want to have intimate relations with. Because by definition, whatever your assumptions are will be wrong. And so just ask, you know, neutral questions about all of these different topics and show a healthy respect and curiosity for your patients in terms of who they are. And that's what you teach in family medicine and your family, for individuals and families, and what we teach in pediatrics and adolescent medicine as well. So so the field is very evolving. Challenges for the future, training. We need to train medical students about LGBT medicine and transgender medicine. We need newer guidelines for gender non-binary individuals, and we need better reproductive options. I want to talk just a little bit about LGBT issues. LGBT individuals, or sexual and gender minorities, are at increased risk for negative health outcomes, particularly substance abuse, depression, anxiety, and suicide. And many sexual and gender minority youth and adults have experienced victimization. And it is the victimization that leads to these negative health outcomes. There is nothing inherent with being LGBTQ which predisposes you towards having depression, anxiety, or other mental health issues. It is the victimization, the harassment, and the bullying that LGBTQ youth face which predispose them towards these outcomes. Now, there are other health disparities. Lesbians are less likely to get preventive services for cancer, particularly reproductive cancers. So mammograms, pap smears, GYN exams in general, and that's an issue for your primary care patients and something to teach your students. Gay men still represent 2/3 of new HIV infections, and I'll give you a starting statistic. Black men who have sex with men, using the CDC criteria, have a 50% lifetime prevalence of contracting HIV. 50% of black men who have sex with men will contract HIV in their lifetime. We have not done, and this is in the age of PrEP. This is in the age of PrEP and post-exposure prophylaxis and pre-exposure prophylaxis, and that we still have 50% of black men who have sex with men get HIV. So we are not getting our message through. We're not teaching it enough, and we're not getting it through. Weight issues, and I mentioned those other issues. 1/3 of transgender individuals have a negative reaction from their healthcare provider. 40% of transgender individuals have attempted suicide. HIV is more common. And with regressive laws about restrooms, many individuals won't use the bathroom consistent with their gender identity, and kids get urinary tract infections. So it's the oppression and discrimination which lead to these negative health outcomes. And so our role is to assist patients in a healthy discovery and autonomy and self-acceptance, make the clinical environment safe and accessible for LGBTQ youth, create an open and honest dialogue, youth and adults, be non-judgmental about these issues, respect confidentiality, and have resources, and teach your students to have resources. Teach your students to have resources. Is there an LGBT community center in your area? Where would LGBTQ go to individuals for healthcare? Where would a transgender individual go? Is there a youth center? Do you know these things? So your students and residents know these things, because when LGBTQ people come, that's what they need. In Pennsylvania, there is no statewide anti-discrimination protections for employment, housing, and public accommodations. So that means that as the Physician General and Acting Secretary of Health, someone can say, oh, I've seen you. You're the transgender Physician General. Now, I have to tell you, if you're not transgender, you're cisgender. It's cis and trans, like it's all I remember from organic chemistry. Remember that, cis and trans? So if you're not transgender, you're cisgender. So if I'm the transgender Physician General, who's the cisgender Physician General? I've never met that person. And so they're not coming to work, I can tell you. So I'm just the Physician General and Acting Secretary. But I could go to buy a house, and in most places of Pennsylvania, they say, oh, I've seen you on TV, isn't that wonderful? No, I won't sell you a house, you're trans. And that would be legal in most parts of Pennsylvania. I transitioned at the Penn State Hershey Medical Center, you know, Penn State, but if I transitioned to a private practice down the street, they could have said, oh, you're fired. And that would be legal in most places in Pennsylvania, not Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, but in most places. And that's for gay and lesbian individuals as well. You can get married with marriage equality, put your wedding picture on your desk, and be fired in most places in Pennsylvania. So we have a work group, and I'm very proud to chair the governor's LGBTQ work group. And there's the governor sitting next to us. We have the entire alphabet soup of agencies that work on these issues while we advocate for non-discrimination legislation with the very conservative legislature. But we're not waiting, and so we have many different policies and practices that we've implemented. We've changed the rules for birth certificates that you don't have to have surgery to change your gender on your birth certificate. Our birth certificates now say parent-parent as opposed to mother-father. Pennsylvania Medicaid covers gender confirmation treatment, including surgery. We need more access to treatment. Many different things that many of the departments have done to improve health equity and general and fairness for LGBT individuals. So I have some more things, but actually I think am I running out of time? Well, I'll just keep going. There you go. I don't care. I just wanted to finish up with a couple things about public health. You know, health is a state of physical, social, mental well-being, not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. And you as family physicians know that better than almost any medical specialty with us pediatricians. There are physical health issues. One of the health issues in Pennsylvania that no one thinks about is Lyme disease. We have the most cases of Lyme disease in the country. And you can see from 2008, 2016, how it has spread in the Northeast. And so we have a campaign, don't let a tick make you sick. Who comes up with these things? To deal with Lyme disease. Mental health issues, depression. It's one of the leading causes of disability worldwide. Eating disorders. Eating disorders was my field before I went to state government. And anorexia nervosa has the highest mortality of any mental illness. And then environmental health issues. We're dealing with significant issues in terms of lead poisoning. Pennsylvania ranks third in the nation for housing units built before 1950. And so we are recommending universal blood lead testing by family physicians and pediatricians for children under two to establish the burden of lead. And we have a task force about that. And then finally, just to finish with the importance that you started with, Doctor, with the social determinants of health. You know, there was public health 1.0, clean water. You know, sanitation has probably done more to help public health than anything. But immunizations, one of the victories of the 20th and 21st century, although under siege sometimes. Public health 2.0, chronic disease management, which we all are expert at now, particularly in family medicine, internal medicine, et cetera. And the third challenge of the social determinants of health, adverse childhood experiences, housing, education, social support, finances, employment, communities, and access to health services. And so that, in addition to the usual medicine that we teach students, and some of these other issues, we need to teach about the social determinants of health and public health 3.0. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.